From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, we remember the Woodstock Festival on the eve of its 40th anniversary with Barry Melton. He played there as lead guitarist and a singer in Country Joe and the Fish. Plus, the great soul singer and songwriter James Ingram. And Mix Picks. It's Mick Martin with some cool new blues songs on the latest edition of Sound Advice. But first, if you run a wine company in Sutter Creek, do you have the right to use that name when another wine company has already trademarked the name Sutter? Sutter Creek Wine Tasting is dealing with this question right now because of legal pressure from Sutter Home Family Winery, a wine company with a trademark name. It's based in Napa. Recently, another Amador County wine company changed its name for similar reasons. The former Sutter Ridge Winery is now Sierra Ridge. We're going to talk about this with one of the people involved and a couple of experts on these matters. We'll start with Jack Feichner, who's managing partner of Sutter Creek Wine Tasting. Jack, welcome.
Thank you very much.
When did you first learn that there might be a legal problem with the name Sutter Creek Wine Tasting?
Well, I received a letter from the lawyer, trademark lawyer for Sutter Home, claiming that Sutter Home had marks of Sutter and Creek. And that was my first indication that there was a potential conflict.
What did they tell you to do or ask?
Well, they as I understand it, as I remember, the letter followed my trademarking of the phrase Sutter Creek Wine Tasting. I had gone online at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office and trademarked it. And that was strictly because I realized we were getting more business and so forth, and I thought it would be the prudent thing to do.
And the U.S. office approved your trademark application?
Yes, they did.
You have a connection to the former Sutter Ridge Winery, now Sierra Ridge, because they are a partner winery in the Sutter Creek Wine Tasting.
That's correct. They have recently become a partner.
They also got pressure, came under pressure from Sutter Home Family Winery, and they did change their name. What happened there? Can you tell us?
I can't tell you anything about that particular incident. All I know is that they were essentially forced to change their name.
What was your response to the request by Sutter Home Family Winery that you consider changing your name?
Well, I told them that I would think about it and that we're still considering other options in terms of what the name might be.
And have you finished thinking about it?
No, we haven't.
When did all this happen?
Oh, I could look up in my records, but it was, it seems to me, maybe April of this year. I'm not sure of that, but I could look it up in my
records.
That's okay.
We don't need exact dates, just the rough timeline. Mm-hmm. Jack Feichner, managing partner of Sutter Creek Wine Tasting, which is under legal pressure from Sutter Home Family Winery, which trademarked the Sutter name. We invited Sutter Home Family Winery to join this discussion, and specifically Ronald Larson, who's their general counsel. We were never actually told no, but we were sent a statement. It's too long for me to read on the air, but I will read the pertinent parts of it. The holding company is Trinchero Family Estates. They say, to the extent that businesses utilize the term Sutter as a trademark for wine or other wine-related goods and services, Trinchero will be forced to assert its trademark rights so as not to relinquish such rights under U.S. trademark law. Trinchero Family Estates has sold over 1 billion bottles of Sutter Home wine and has spent millions of dollars advertising and promoting the brand. The statement goes on, and this is referring to the Sutter Ridge Winery application and its owner, John Bree. When Trinchero learned of John Bree's trademark application, it was required by law to object to such use to protect the value of the Sutter Home mark. And one final pertinent point from the Trinchero Family Estates statement: they will not assert their trademark rights in the marks to block businesses in Sutter Creek, California, which are using that town's name for goods and services unrelated to wine. In our studio is a law professor who is an expert on intellectual property law and writes about the law's effects on culture. She's Madhavi Sundar, professor of law at UC Davis. Madhavi, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Is the kind of dispute that we're hearing about here, is this common?
Oh, yes, because we have seen a real rise in the kinds of things that can be trademarked in very recent history. Trademark is age old, but more recently we see as brands become increasingly important commercial properties, we see more and more trademarking of many things, which leads to the butting of heads amongst many people who want to naturally use these are words, names, symbols that are common and used descriptively by many people for different purposes. So there are naturally going to be conflicts.
What does it mean legally, trademark?
A trademark is really any name or word or symbol or device that can indicate the maker of the product or the source of the product. And so I think many people are familiar with names like Nike or symbols like the swoosh. But in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court has interpreted devices that are trademarkable very broadly. So, for example, a color can be trademarked if it indicates the source. So if you're lucky enough to get the little blue box on your anniversary, you know immediately that that's from Tiffany's. So colors can be trademarked if they indicate a source. A sound can be trademarked. The lovely music at the beginning of your program, which I just enjoyed, certainly if that indicates the source of this program, it can be trademarked. So sounds, colors, even distinctive shapes, like the shape of a Coca-Cola bottle, can be trademarked. Now, the key issue, though, is whether or not there's actually a signaling function with respect to who the maker is.
What do you mean?
So if, for example, the color doesn't tell us the maker of the product, but it simply makes the product look pretty, then that is not something that would be protected as a trademark.
What gives you the right to trademark something?
Well, typically, the historical justification is that these brands or symbols perform an important public service by protecting consumers. They quickly and efficiently give consumers information about a product. So when you're busy and running through the aisles of the supermarket, you can just find Tide detergent by the bright colors of the box, the design, the name. So the efficiency of these brands, these little symbols that are packed with meaning and information, is something we want to protect. But I think, as we heard from the letter from Sutter Home, another more recently important justification for trademarks, aside from just consumer protection, is also the idea that companies today spend lots and lots of money and capital on building a brand, building that recognition. And the brands themselves have basically become one of the most important assets of a company. So this, so there's kind of a conflict with respect to why we protect trademarks. It historically was to protect consumers against confusing uses, but now it's also to protect the corporate makers of the brands themselves.
My guest is Madhavi Sundar. She's a professor of law at UC Davis. We're talking about a trademark legal dispute in the Amador County wine business. I can see that if you try and start up a sporting good company called Nike, that Nike could say, hey, no, we own that trademark.
Right.
But it seems like there's something a little different going on here. Sutter Creek Wine Tasting is a wine tasting business based in Sutter Creek. How could Sutter Home tell them you can't call yourself that?
Sure. I mean, so at the same time that we recognize trademarks as serving this important function, we also recognize that there can be too much of a good thing, and there are exceptions. So one important exception is when we're talking about property rights or exclusive rights in words and names, well, we really always have to be concerned about trampling on the First Amendment and freedom of speech. So these are also words that we use to describe ourselves, the communities in which we live, and that's the case here with Sutter Creek. It's the name of the town, and Sutter Creek Wine Tasting is just merely a description of this service that's offered, where three different local wineries in Amador County come together and you can taste their wines. So there is actually a fair use exception as well that might be relevant in this context, where if the wine tasting is simply using the name Sutter to describe its services, it may be okay. So again, the key issue with respect to trademark law is whether or not, one, consumers are confused, but also, is there some other non-commercial use being made?
Sounds like you're saying that that Sutter Creek Wine Tasting could have a case. Could make a case.
Everyone can have a case.
Well, that's true, but a reasonable chance.
You know, I think that it's really important. This law is about fundamentally about protecting consumers and making common sense decisions about the way we regulate language and police language. It's important. It's one of the First Amendment is a bedrock of, you know, our constitutional system here. So they have a case.
Jack Feichner, managing partner of Sutter Creek Wine Tasting. Do you have a personal reaction to this whole issue based in part on what Madhavi Sundar has been saying, but also just your observations?
Yes, I think that she has made some very trenchant points. Well, of course, I agree with her.
Also with us is Kim Elsbach, who's a professor at the UC Davis Graduate School of Management. Her specialties include organizational identity, negotiation skills, and handling reputation crises. Kim, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
What would you say to a company like Sutter Creek Wine Tasting that is under legal pressure from a bigger company to change its name, and also the related case of Sierra Ridge Winery, which bowed to that pressure and changed its name from Sutter Ridge Winery?
Well, my focus is more on the identity of the organization and the meaning and the symbolism of the name to the people who own the winery or run the winery, rather than the legal end of it.
Sure.
And people have strong connections to those names beyond their legal precedent. They mean something to people, and over time that meaning can grow and take on sort of other connotations. And I was listening to the law professor with great interest because I think the law, as it was originally intended, was to protect consumers. But lots of times now we've seen organizations and companies change their names in ways that seem to undermine that. For example, Philip Morris, which became very much associated with cigarettes, has changed their name to Altria Group, and in a sense to protect its other businesses like Nabisco, which makes Oreo cookies. And when you hear the word Altria Group, you don't think of cigarettes like you used to with Philip Morris. So in some ways, the changing of names can sometimes perhaps hurt consumers because they don't know who they're dealing with. But in my research that I found, people have strong identities associated with the names of their organizations, and changing the name of that not only has a legal implication, but it changes a perception of who they are. Wine companies are commonly associated with places and or family names. And here we have a case where there's both happening, and there's a conflict between one winery that's associated with a place and another that's associated with a family name. And so both have strong interests in keeping those identities as they have been.
Do you think that's a strong enough need to be worth fighting it, even though you're up against a much larger company?
Especially if they've developed an identity around Sutter Creek, and that the people who come to their wine tastings and buy their wines now think of Sutter Creek in association with those products, that identity is associated with many other things, including their wines. And if you just change the name, then you confuse the consumer, and they don't have that same association. The schema that they've developed in their mind about what Sutter Creek means is very important to maintain. And if you just change the name overnight, those schemas get disrupted.
Would you advise a company in these situations to let the public know, we're changing our name because of this reason, because of legal pressure from another bigger company? Or would you suggest they just forget about all that, move on, change the name?
Yeah, it depends on how important that name is to their products. And if they have a sense that people really strongly associate the name Sutter Creek with their wines and with the wine tasting venue itself, then I would suggest it would be worth fighting to maintain their name. If they feel that the wines and the wine tasting place stand on its own without confusion, and the name isn't that that strongly associated, then they might want to just change it and put some advertising out there that makes it clear that this is who we are and these are our wines and et cetera.
Kim Ellsback, professor at the UC Davis Graduate School of Management. Madhavi Sundar, any final thoughts from you on this matter?
No, well, just that what's a shame about this is that, you know, there may be a great legal case, but it takes a lot of time and money, and the little guy usually gives up on that, and understandably so.
Jack Feichner, is the little guy going to give up?
The little guy is thinking of different schemes, and we haven't made a decision yet.
Do you know when you'll make a decision?
Probably in the next few months.
Okay. Well, we'd like to check back in with you when you do.
Okay. And I'd also like to mention that Sutter Creek is also becoming a wine tasting venue with there's now a new winery coming into town just two doors away from us in a tasting room. So Sutter Creek is rapidly becoming a wine tasting venue.
Maybe you should try and trademark the name Sutter Creek. Jack Feichner, managing partner of Sutter Creek Wine Tasting, which is under legal pressure from the larger Sutter Home Family Winery to change its name because Sutter Home has trademarked the Sutter name in the context of the wine business. Also, our guests, Madhavi Sundar, professor of law at UC Davis, and Kim Ellsback, professor at the UC Davis Graduate School of Management. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, we remember Woodstock on the eve of its 40th anniversary with a musician who played there. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Listen to Insight at your convenience. Sign up for our podcast at capradio.org/insight. The most famous rock music festival is about to turn 40. The Woodstock Festival started on August 15th, 1969 and ran for 4 days. Many of the most famous rock musicians and bands of all time played there, including Jimi Hendrix, The Who, Santana, and The Grateful Dead. Another highlight band at the festival was the Bay Area's Country Joe and the Fish. Co-founder, lead guitarist, and singer Barry Melton was there, and he's in our studio today. Barry, welcome to Insight.
Well, thank you, and it's good to be home. I'm a West Sacramento resident these days, so I'm just the other side of the river, and it took me less than 15 minutes to get here by car.
Well, that's excellent to hear. Go back 40 years, just before Woodstock started. What were you and other people who were heading there thinking? Did you think, wow, this is just going to be the most amazing festival people have ever heard?
Well, you know, to put it in context, Woodstock came at a time of huge rock festivals. And I was looking recently on the internet because I've been talking a lot to people about Woodstock over the last few weeks. And Woodstock occurred in the same month as the Atlanta Pop Festival and the Atlantic City Pop Festival. There was no reason to know or believe that Woodstock was going to be anything other than those other festivals. It was originally planned to be, I believe, somewhere in the 40, 50,000 people range, which was typical of festivals of that time.
But in fact, hundreds of thousands of people showed up.
That's because they crashed the gates and didn't pay. I don't think we could have known that.
What made it so special?
Because 350,000 people showed up uninvited. and they crashed the gates. And then it ended up being sort of a statement of a whole generation of a kind. And the movie then remains this enduring social document of that period of our history.
We're remembering Woodstock. It started 40 years ago this weekend. My guest is Barry Melton, a.k.a. Barry the Fish Melton. He was co-founder, lead guitarist, and a singer in the band Country Joe and the Fish, which played at Woodstock. He also recently retired as Yolo County Public Defender. Let's listen to you singing at Woodstock. It's the song Love, performed by Country Joe and the Fish, and you're singing and playing guitar.
Deep in my heart, baby, I know that you care. Deep in my
Barry, can you still belt it out like that?
I can, but it's somewhat more subtle than today.
Yeah.
Than it was back then. Very raw back then.
I was watching a video of that this morning on YouTube, and it was pouring with rain when you were singing.
You know, I flew over on a helicopter the morning of our performance, or the day of our performance, with Joe Cocker in the helicopter. He went on just before us, and then there was an intermission of 2 hours or so for a rainstorm. And my biggest role in the movie is not performing that song or any other. I'm the guy who was shouting, "No rain, no rain," and trying to convince all those people that if they put their heads together, they could somehow stop the rain. So people ask me, you know, have things changed? And I think to some degree, my idea that 300,000 or 400,000 people can put their heads together and stop a natural event has actually been altered since I was young.
What impact did all that rain have? Did it literally dampen enthusiasm, or did it somehow add another interesting element to the festival?
Well, we began playing sort of rhythm instruments. The rhythms got picked up by the crowd, and ultimately, probably the only opportunity the crowd got to make music was during the rainstorm. It sort of evolved into this giant rhythmic undulating explosion with a chant. And if you watch the movie, you'll hear the only real crowd participation, extended crowd participation, was during the rainstorm.
You were wearing a really cool coat.
Yeah, well, it was colorful. Those were colorful times. We can certainly say that. But, you know, I have come to the conclusion that what happened at Woodstock, which was very much an East Coast event, was the echo of something we started here on the West Coast. The gestalt of the Summer of Love, that whole counterculture thing that we were doing there really began here in Northern California and then migrated to the East. So while New York can lay claim to having the big festival that was filmed by Warner Brothers, we here on the West Coast can say we're really the people who started all of that.
Barry Melton was a co-founder and one of the leaders of the band Country Joe and the Fish, which played at the Woodstock Festival 40 years ago this weekend, and we're recalling Woodstock. Let's listen to another excerpt from the Woodstock Festival, and this is Country Joe's famous performance of the "I Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die" rag. And for people who know what happens in this, we have taken care of it for FCC purposes.
About 300,000 of you out there. I want you to start singing. Come on. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6.
What was that like when the whole crowd is singing along?
Oh, it's great. I think one of the really cool things, and like I say, one of the reasons why I like the rain chant, is when the audience really gets to express itself, it becomes way huger than 5, 6, or 10 people can do on a stage by themselves. One of the magic things about, for example, a Pete Seeger performance was his ability to harness the audience as part of the music.
Give us another highlight for you of Woodstock, maybe musical or personal or whatever.
I think my most prominent memory of the event is flying over in a helicopter. I had this young guy on the helicopter named Joe Cocker who was riding along with me, and I had never heard of Joe Cocker, and I didn't know who he was. I later got to see his performance and realized he was fantastic. But coming in on the helicopter from that distance of 12 or 15 miles from the hotel to the site, we ran at treetop level and we could look down at these enormous encampments of people. And a lot of the visual image that we have of Woodstock is that movie image of the stage and, you know, the amphitheater configuration of 300,000 people watching the stage. But in reality, there were probably closer to 500,000 or so people there. And the other couple of 100,000 people were interspersed in the woods that cannot be seen from the stage or by a camera. And flying in on the helicopter at treetop level, we saw the thousands and thousands and thousands of people who were in the woods. And I don't know how well they heard the music at all, but they were definitely at Woodstock.
What about the big names like The Who and Jimi Hendrix? Any particular memories of them at Woodstock?
Yeah, I remember that. I remember seeing The Who. I didn't stay long enough, honestly, to see Jimi Hendrix. I was in a rush to get back home and flew back with the Grateful Dead in the early morning hours, probably around the time he was playing. But I remember seeing The Who. They had a huge confrontation with Abbie Hoffman on stage that ended up being a political controversy in the years that followed. The performances that I remember are the ones the evening before we played, which are Joan Baez, the debut of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, the performance of Arlo Guthrie, which I remember was just, you know, really fantastic and really moving.
So it sounds like you have happy memories of it all.
Overall, on the balance.
Overall.
I mean, it was a pretty rough concert site. And the people who were closest to the stage, which are the ones that, as a performer, you see and you relate to closest, they had not a lot of access to water or sanitation, because if you managed to work yourself to the front of the crowd, you had worked yourself away from the loo and away from water. And that was difficult. So one of the first things we did when the rainstorm started is we ran backstage. We took all the drinks from the performers' lounge and we passed them out to the crowd in front of the stage, because they were obviously really thirsty.
We've been remembering Woodstock. Its 40th anniversary is this weekend. Barry Melton was there. He as co-founder, lead guitarist, and a singer in the band Country Joe and the Fish. Barry Melton, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you so much, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the great soul singer and songwriter James Ingram. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download previous editions of Insight. Find our archives at capradio.org/insight. Many of the most popular soul and R&B songs of the last 25 years were written and or sung by James Ingram. They include Baby Come to Me, the duet with Patti Austin, Yamo Be There, the duet with Michael McDonald, and PYT, co-written by Ingram and made famous by Michael Jackson. James Ingram's latest album is called Stand in the Light. This Sunday, he's in Reno playing at the Reno Tahoe Blues Fest. He joins us by phone. James Ingram, welcome to Insight.
Oh, well, how you doing, Jeffrey?
Well, I'm doing well. You know, you grew up in Akron, Ohio. What kind of music did you grow up with?
I grew up with all kind of music. I mean, from the funk to the pop, the R&B, the jazz, and gospel music.
At what point did you realize you were going to be a professional musician, and what kind of musician did you see yourself being?
I was in a group in Akron, Ohio called Revelation Funk, and I graduated in 1970. In 1973, we came out here to Los Angeles, California, and we were out here for about 9 years, and then the group broke up, and they went back to Akron, Ohio, and I told them to have a safe trip because I come out here to get into the music business, so... I've had a chance to play, you know, behind Ray Charles. I can see clearly that's me playing the organ and playing drums on Game Number 9 for Ray, and co-wrote You 20th Century Fox.
You've had a lot of success in various ways as a singer, as a composer, as a producer. Back in the day, did you see yourself more in one of those directions?
Oh, no doubt about it. Jeffrey, I was just a musician. That's me playing on She's Bad Mama Jam with Carl Carlton and all that stuff. And Night to Remember by Shalimar. So I was a musician. I didn't consider myself a singer. But what happened, I was writing with Buzzy Featon, with Larson and Featon. And I could sing better than him, so I did our demos. And he got me a job singing demos for $50 a song. And I would go up there and learn a song for an hour and then sing it. Then they give me my $50, and then they give me a copy of it. And one of the copies was Just Once. And they got it to Quincy Jones because they knew he was going in the studio for his album, and they thought it was appropriate for him. And he called them back and said, well, who is this guy singing? And they said, well, he's just a piano player for Ray Charles. He's just a demo singer. He said, can I get his number? Quincy called me, and he said he wanted me to sing on his album. I said, you sure you don't want me to play? He said, no, I want you to sing. So when I got in the studio, I kept stopping the tape. He said, why are you stopping? I said, well, I'm trying to clean this the gruff out of my voice. He said, no, that's why you're in here. That's your sound.
Wow. My guest is James Ingram, the Grammy-winning soul singer and songwriter. He plays Sunday evening in Reno at the Reno Tahoe Blues Fest. Just Once, that was, I think, your first hit single. Another early hit for you was Baby Come to Me, the duet with Patty Austin. Let's listen to a bit of it.
Spending every dime to keep you talking on the line. That's how it was. And all those walks together, out in any kind of weather, just because there's a brand new way of looking at your life when you know that love is standing by your side.
Baby, come to me. Let me put my arms around you. This one,
James Ingram, it's such a great song, and yet it really took off in part because it was played on the soap opera General Hospital. What did you and Patty Austin make of that?
Well, first of all, Patty and myself and Quincy, the song came out and it didn't do anything. And then months later, I was over at Quincy's house and he got a phone call and somebody told him that the song was climbing back up the charts. And Quincy investigated it and we found out that it was played on General Hospital, and that's what launched the song. Not the record company.
You mentioned your work with Quincy Jones, and associated with that was your songwriting. You co-wrote the song PYT that, of course, was made famous by Michael Jackson. How did that come about?
You know, Quincy was married to Peggy Lipton. Peggy came home with some lingerie which said Pretty Young Things. And so Quincy took Pretty Young Things and said Pretty Young Thing and TLC, 10, 11 Care. And so that was a good hook for Quincy. So he sent me and a lot of other songwriters at that title. And when I came back with my demo, I didn't even have all the lyrics, but I had enough of the melody and the verse and the chorus, and he said, we're cutting this tomorrow.
And how similar was your demo version of the song to what ended up performed by Michael Jackson?
Well, the melody is the same. It's just that he, you know, the ad-libs is his own.
My guest is James Ingram, the soul singer. He's at the Reno Tahoe Blues Fest this weekend. He plays Sunday evening at 8. Let's listen to another one of your most famous songs. This is another duet. You've done many duets over the years. This is Yam Will Be There with Michael McDonald.
Heavenly Father, watching us fall.
Co-wrote that song. What does the title refer to?
God by his Hebrew name.
Yeah.
When you're in the church, you say hallelujah.
Yes.
And so Heavenly Father watching us fall, that's what we were talking about.
And there is a strong faith element in your most recent album, Stand in the Light. We're going to listen to part of that song, the title song, Stand in the Light. But tell us what motivated your most recent work.
Well, Stand in the Light was written by Debbie Allen and myself, and it really came behind the devastation of Katrina and what was going on. It was just such a disaster in our country that I've never seen before like that.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to part of the song.
Oh, oh, oh. In a time when the words of the truth are not spoken, there's a war, there's hatred tearing us apart, and the sea reaches high to horizons now broken, and the world is so weary and frightened.
must go. Go on and stand in the light. You will hear your soul singing. Stand.
Finally, James Ingram, do you have any thoughts about the untimely death of Michael Jackson, who you knew?
Well, it was just tragic. It was just tragic. Matter of fact, Quincy Jones was over in Europe waiting on his first show. And when it happened, Quincy just stayed in Europe. Matter of fact, me and Patty and myself, we just got back 2 days ago from Italy, being with Quincy. So it was devastating.
Yes. James Ingram, Grammy-winning soul singer and songwriter. He plays Sunday evening at 8 in Reno at the Reno Tahoe Blues Fest, which runs Friday through Sunday. James Ingram, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, some great new blues picked for you by Mick Martin on the latest edition of Sound Advice. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. It's Thursday, and so it's time for Sound Advice, our weekly music feature where Capital Public Radio music hosts and others choose new, reissued, or otherwise notable music. This week, I'm joined by blues musician and blues DJ Mick Martin. Mick, welcome back to Insight.
No, it's good to be here, Jeffrey. It's good to see you.
Who would you like to start with?
Well, you know, the man, I call him the hardest working man in show business, Tommy Castro. I mean, he's been on the road and working it, and he's got a new album. I think it's his first for Alligator, so he's changed labels, and this man has been working it for so long that I have an enormous respect for him. And he also brought a lot of R&B influence into the blues. So with Tommy Castro, you hear all kinds of music when he plays.
And what's the song we're going to hear?
This is his version of Wilson Pickett's 99 and a Half Just Won't Do.
Yes, I do. 99 and a half just won't do. No, baby, ain't gonna get it now, now.
Wow, that's about as soulful as blues gets.
Isn't it? And, you know, he's been doing this for a few years. He started off with the Dynatones and went out on his own, and he has just become a phenomenon through strictly hard work, playing a lot and traveling all over the country.
And that song's from his album, Hard Believer. It's a new album. And then Mick, as some people know, he's playing at Capital Public Radio pretty
soon. Yeah, our first concert here on site. It's exciting.
Yeah, it's October 11th, and it's going to be in the grassy area behind our studios. If you know where we are, you'll know what we're talking about. It's Sound Advice. My guest is Mick Martin, blues musician with Mick Martin and the Blues Rockers and host of Mick Martin's Blues Party Saturday afternoons on the station. What's the next song and artist?
Well, I thought it might be almost thematic if we picked the fellow who actually started the trend that Tommy Castro has picked up on, Robert Cray, who's one of the more soulful blues men. If you look at his career, he started on high tone with a group of albums and songs like Strong Persuader that mixed blues with soul music in a way that it really hadn't been before successfully. So Robert Cray, with the help of Dennis Walker, who's a singer-songwriter, crafted this new form of blues. And now this is his first album in 5 years called This Time. And I think it's right up there with the best work he's ever done.
And the song is?
Well, this one is called Chicken in the Kitchen.
That's a great title.
Cooking in our house, babe. You're always running around.
cooking in our house, babe. You're always running around. There'll be no more chicken in the kitchen if you don't try and settle down.
That's Chicken in the Kitchen by the Robert Cray Band. I love the sound of that rhythm guitar.
Yeah, doesn't he have a I think we can say that he's truly one of those artists that you can pick out. You can say, that's Robert Cray. He's so distinctive. And the boy funky.
He certainly is.
He's certainly funky. I remember when he did a Sacramento Blues Festival, and this is in the early time of his career, where Curtis Salgado was playing harmonica in the band, and I actually took him home and made a barbecue dinner for him because they were staying in a motel on 16th Street, just this beat-up place. And now look at him. You know, he's become an international phenomenon, and his records are an event. So this is an event. It just released in the last few days, in the last week or so.
Who's our third artist we're going to listen to?
Big Bill Morganfield. You know, there are a lot of sons and daughters of blues people. The John Lee Hooker family, of course, there's quite a few. And this is Big Bill Morganfield. He's Muddy Waters' son. And before he even started messing around with the music, he learned it. And one of his teachers is the producer of this new album, which is called Born Lover, Bob Margolin, who, interestingly enough, was taught how to play the style of blues by Muddy Waters himself and was in the band for like 9 years that backed up Muddy. So he went to the people who his dad taught so that he could find out how to do it right. And I think he does. On this one, this is called Too Late, Brother, which was a Little Walter song.
That jive ain't no need of going no farther, man.
It's a new record, but it's got an old school sound.
No, it's the real deal, and that's what I think is important about what he did. He didn't just rush out, as some of the family members have done of departed blues greats, and didn't do an album right away. He waited until he got it right, and his records have been of a very high quality. And so this new one is something I'd stand up for. Somebody said, I want to hear the old blues on a new album. This is the one I tell him to pick up.
It's Sound Advice on Insight, our weekly music feature this week. We're listening to the blues with Mick Martin. Who's our fourth artist?
Sacramento's own, Rick Estrin. Although he came out of the Bay Area, he's been here for 30 years almost. And Little Charlie and the Nightcats, like Tommy Castro, took the same path. They played everywhere. And the irony, of course, is that everybody thought the lead singer was Little Charlie. And recently, Little Charlie Beatty, who is a bebop guitar player of the first order and truly unique, and that's a word I try not to ever use, people thought Little Charlie wasn't in the band, so they thought Rick wasn't in the band. Those of us who know him, of course, and have followed him. He's the Sonny Boy Williamson of our time. His lyrics are sharp and humorous. He's a philosopher, a showman, and probably one of the three greatest harmonica players living today.
And a very well-dressed gentleman.
Always, always in those alligator shoes, man. In fact, he told Two Tone Steiny when he was trying to make up his mind whether to buy these expensive shoes in Chicago, Rick said, gotta take care of your feet, man. Buy a cheap polyester suit, but take care of your feet.
And what's the song we're going to hear by Rick Astron?
It's something called You Be You and I'll Be Me.
That's Rick Astron and the Night Cats, the song UBU from their album Twisted. Who's next?
Eddie C. Campbell. And a lot of people don't know who he is, but he's part of that West Side scene that came along. It was the last big explosion in blues. Otis Rush, Buddy Guy, and Magic Sam. Eddie C. Campbell has finally made an album worthy of him. His first album came out in the 60s, and it was called King of the Jungle. And we play him every Christmas, something called Santa's Messing with a Kid. But it's Delmark, which was the original label, the first label to put out a full-length LP of blues.
The song Voodoo and the album Tear This World Up. Let's listen to Voodoo.
My flowers won't grow, the mule won't pull.
That's got a kind of sinister, swampy sound.
Yes, and he's one of those artists that's overlooked. And a lot of the great blues people, of course, you know, it seems like every month or so, every 2 months, I'm doing a number of obituaries for great blues players. And he's one of the originators who's still around. And Delmark is one of the labels that helped put blues on the map with our generation, the baby boomer generation. So Eddie C. Campbell, if you're looking for the real deal by one of the originals, that's the one to get.
And we're just about out of time, but we do have time for one last song.
We've got a band playing at the Torch Club in Sacramento tonight, which was one of the original British invasion blues bands, and they're still going. Fleetwood Mac is gone, Chicken Shack is gone, but Savoy Brown just keeps cooking on. And this is a song called Keeping the Dream Alive.
Time has passed away. Do you remember when? Walking through the city park, hanging with our friends. I'm keeping the dream alive. I couldn't do it without.
That's fun music, isn't it?
Yeah, it's infectious. And this album, a lot of people overlooked it. It's called Steel. Kim Simmons is now his own lead singer after having Dave Walker and Chris Yolden. And he's developed into a great front man. And as you can hear, that slide guitar just, it's great. He's one of the finest guitar players to come out of England when it comes to the blues.
That's great. Savoy Brown and the song Keeping the Dream Alive. Mick Martin of Mick Martin and the Blues Rockers and host of Mick Martin's Blues Party Saturday afternoons in the station. Mick, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callis, and today's associate producers were Kelly Menemeyer, Linnea Edmeyer, and Ellie Fox. It's Linnea's last day with us. She's going back to Berkeley, her graduate journalism program. Thanks, Linnea. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard, and thank you for joining us. What happens to police dogs when they retire? On the next Insight, you'll hear about efforts to ensure decent care for retired canines. Also, pet expert Gina Spadafori on the shelter reform movement, Michael Vick, and other animal-related issues. Plus, a new book about how plans to build high-speed train lines get waylaid, and the psychedelic indie band Buildings Breeding plays in our studio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.